Sunstone presents How Public Are Utah's Public Schools? Recorded live at the 1986 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 20th through the 23rd. We take you to the Salt Lake Sheraton and Towers, where the program is just now beginning.
The Sunstone Symposium, How Public Are Utah's Public Schools? And my subtitle for that was, Are Utah Public Schools, in fact, a private school system? The purpose of this panel is to explore the issue of the influence of Mormons on the public schools of Utah and the relevance of such a condition to cultural pluralism in our state. Thanks, Ray. Close that door. I sent the panelists a list of questions, and if we try to answer them all, we'll probably be here until next symposium. But maybe we can have a session on this called the Public Schools in Utah 2. But essentially what we want to do is discuss as much as we can the issue of the influence of Mormon values, Mormon beliefs, Mormon politics on the public schools of Utah, and try and ferret out the dimensions of that problem, to what extent is it a problem, and give some instances of it. And then we'd like the committee, the panel, to discuss how the problem might be alleviated. Should begin by saying that Utah has the least percentage of its students involved in private education. It has the most public school system in the United States. Fewer students in Utah go to private schools. A reversal from what it was in 1890, by the way, when Utah had the highest number of its students going to private schools, Mormon and non-Mormon. My own experience here, just about 10 years or 12 years ago, I received a clipping from BYU Universe dealing with a story an investigative reporter had done at the BYU on the problem of non-Mormons in the public schools of Utah County. That sparked my interest in it, and Ray Briscoe and I did a little study on it. The issue seems to come up frequently. To what extent are Utah public schools really public? So, I'd like to introduce the panel to you. On my right here is Glenn Halby, Provo Community
Congregational Church.
Provo Community Congregational Church. Lamont Lyons from Boise State University College of Education. Anne Hart from the Department of Educational Administration at the University of Utah. And John McGean of Judge Memorial High School in Salt Lake City. So, we'd just like to begin by posing the first question and have the panelists jump in. We're trying to make this as informative and as informal as possible. In what way do schools in Utah reflect Mormon values? Is this a positive? Are there positive aspects to this or negative aspects? And let's just begin with that notion.
I'm going to jump in first because I don't represent a particular group other than education in Utah in general. It is my sense that Utah schools reflect Mormon values in the same sense that American public schools tend to reflect the values of the communities in which they exist. The difference, as we've discussed this together before, is that Utah is so dominated by one cultural group that we have a unique situation that simply reflects the status quo in other settings. There are so many people who are so much alike that without thinking, people often say things and do things and make decisions in the public schools based on what their common lives are like. Consequently, Mormonism tends to creep into the public schools, sometimes without people ever intending it to.
I would agree. I think, and I mentioned to Fred, that he may be a troubler of the people, and a disturber of the peace in bringing this issue up at this point in time. In Utah Valley, before I was there as pastor, and looking back in our files and talking with our folks, this had come up in 78 and 79, the issue of religion in schools, the objections, apparently gathering enough steam to be brought up as a public issue by the clergy of the non-Mormon churches in the valley. And then about 4 years later, when I was a clergy, it came up again. Each time, lists of concerns were drawn up, and in number and in nature, they are almost identical, but separated by those 4 years. And in that, this is 4 years after the last such one, almost in fact to the month, August of 82. The cycle may be coming up again in Utah Valley. I suspect it will, because of the nature of the society and the communities in which we live. Occasionally, and I insist in isolated instances, people's toes get stepped upon and they complain. Stepped upon enough that they complain. And that's the phenomenon down in Utah Valley.
I'd like to add one other thing about this that I think it makes it a more general issue, because as I interact with graduate students who plan to become school administrators, they raise the issue, you know, how much can I get away with? Or how do I keep parents off my back? My goal is to have a school where we love children, we love parents, they love us, and no one bothers anybody. There isn't a line of parents at the front of my office to harass me. And regardless of the law or regardless of a set of principles on pluralism in American society, their concern is often negotiating the kinds of pressures that they will receive. And Mormonism or fundamentalist Christianity or whatever that pressure, whatever the source of that pressure, public school administrators feel it and are constantly sensitive to it. So when, as Glenn's organization and the people that he has worked with have to ask, what can we do about teachers who still have opening prayer at the beginning of the school day in their classrooms, in a meeting of principals when I was a junior high school principal, the query was raised from an embattled principal who said, what do I do with the parents who show up on my doorstep to scream at me because we no longer have prayer at the beginning of the day? And those pressures are definitely felt by people.
I don't think school prayer is an issue of Mormons. In fact, it's probably a much deeper issue in other parts of the country than it is in Utah. But the other kind of religious influences may be terribly important. And they probably, I have to be careful in what I say, because it's now been 12 years since I've taught in the public schools of Utah. So I'm sure lots of things have happened. But my impression is that the influence of the church is much more in the informal curriculum than it is in any formal curriculum or even in the formal structure. And that can be attributed to, as we've already said, the overwhelming population in the community of Mormons. Almost would happen, it would be unusual if it did not happen, it seems to me, if there were that kind of informal curriculum influence.
John? This is a hard question for me. I'm not Mormon, and but I did attend public schools for, I think, the first 5 years of my formal education. I had a wonderful time at that stage of my life, by the way. I felt I was the only non-Mormon on my street, on my block, and I had some enormously wonderful friends. I went to school with one of them, as a matter of fact, sitting here in this group today. I felt very much at ease. I felt very comfortable at school, at the public school I attended. as well as home with those friends with whom I was going to school. But I have observed, as an educator, Utah is one of the most frequently asterisked states in all sorts of educational studies, because we seem to, as you might know, never seem to fit any of the other normal patterns. If you look about searching for instance, private schools in the state of Utah, you would note, and I don't have statistics here, but I'm certain that I will draw no arguments, that we have far fewer per capita private schools in our valley and across the state, of course. I am the principal of the only Catholic high school in the valley, in the Salt Lake Valley. There is one other, St. Joseph's High School in Ogden, which has an enrollment 9 through 12 of around 250. There is recently an outgrowth of other private schools and some sectarian schools. There is a Lutheran high school now, which has grown up, and there are several highly conservative private schools which have developed. But I believe that one of the reasons, and I'll just say this, and the panel can either agree or disagree with my thoughts, there is felt among the general feeling among the Mormon, the LDS population, is that there is no need for a private Mormon LDS school system here. And I think that it is quite independent of expense or anything else. I think that it is more a matter of a kind of realization, a kind of contentment that what is going on in the public school systems is very complementary to the whole ethical and value structure of their faith. By the way, I wanted to list some other things that I have noticed, that if these are reflective of Mormon values, they're certainly reflective of Utah schools. We have higher test scores, especially on the secondary level, in SAT test scores. Our students seem to do better on them. We have an enormously larger percentage of students who are involved in advanced placement programs in the state of Utah. And again, we are miles ahead of other states in that regard. And I think that part of that, too, is due to the influence of having such homogeneity in the school system, with a kind of singular work ethic which everyone seems to subscribe to and accept. And I believe that that is at the basis of so that there's much good which goes on, but there is that kind of singularity of purpose that makes us very different.
I don't want the issue of prayer. I agree that many of the aspects of public education in Utah and the problems of objections to some areas of academic freedom would not be unique to the LDS tradition. However, prayer is, in Utah, very distinctly, the issue of prayer in school is very distinctly Mormon, in the very distinct style and manner in which the prayer is offered. This is the most isolating, segregating aspect of school, the organized school in Utah Valley. John Bunyan is up for sainthood in my local church because, as superintendent of schools, he was the first to definitively instruct all principals and school teachers that no defense would be offered by the school district if they should conduct school prayer. And he defined that there will be no prayer in Provo schools or in school-related activities. With few exceptions, we will have prayer along with activities that are related to high school graduation. Also, we will conduct it in an evening or after-school activity involving a meal if people so desire. As far as I know, in the Provo City District, that is pretty much the way things are now, with some exceptions. Athletic events, I think, at times have team prayers. But basically, he is responsible for the most definitive change in that, and sadly enough, the Alpine School and Nebo School districts have not taken that step.
Again, I don't find that very surprising or unusual or very Utah or very Mormon, because in the community I live in, which is distinctly not a Mormon community, coaches have team prayers before games.
Yeah, but you didn't hear the one point, Lamont, in that the Mormon prayer style is different. And the main case that came up, which drew Dr. Binion's response and his support of our complaint, was from a law school professor, a visiting law school professor, whose son was denied the right to pray in a school function because the teacher was afraid for him. He didn't know the format and he didn't know the stance. And that's one thing our people say over and over again is that mode of prayer is as important as the prayer itself.
Would it be all right if it was a Protestant prayer?
No. In fact, I was quoted in a interview at the time that because the practice segregates non-LDS children, setting them apart from others and inviting taunts and teases because they give the prayer the wrong way. No, it's not all right.
That's a very interesting point, because there may be such a thing as a Mormon prayer. I think there is. But I've found that often the LDS kids in the schools in the Boise community are asked to give the prayers before those games because the coach knows they pray and are accustomed to doing that in public and would probably do it.
The good prayers.
Yeah, and even in the university, the central administration in those few occasions, and it's relatively few, but prayer is not that terribly uncommon in the state institution, would frequently ask some Mormon on the faculty or in the administration to offer the prayer, maybe for the same reason. Well, so it turns out, again, I think, to be a Mormon prayer for that reason.
I think I disagree with our moderator here. I don't think any prayer before a football game or by a team is a good prayer. I think it's a trivializing prayer.
What do you mean by that? Can you give us an example?
I just think that prayer is a lot more important than one would engage in it before a school athletic event. At one point, Danny Ainge at BYU, when we first moved in, said that they had won a particular game for the church, and there were several other comments that he made in a series of interviews, and brought God into it at one point, and I didn't make it public, but I guess I would. I simply told my wife that I didn't know if God really cared among 10 young men running around in funny underwear who put the ball through the hoop more often. And I think it's trivializing. Well, but we're getting off the point.
Well, yeah. No, I want to agree with Glenn on that. I don't want my comments to be interpreted as being in favor of those team school prayers and all those kind of things. I agree. I don't think they have any place. And basically for the same reason. Not that it's unconstitutional or inappropriate in the community standard or anything else, but it's trivializing something terribly important.
For persons.
That's correct.
You've mentioned that prayer is an issue, and it's come up frequently, and you said it was like the 13-year locust thing or something.
It's funny you should mention 17-year locust. We have in a special feature that the Daily Herald brought out after the Supreme Court's most recent ruling, a school teacher who said that he'd been leading prayer for 17 years and had no complaints.
Until this was printed.
This was in the Alpine School District, and I suppose he's still doing it. But in John Binion's case and the Provo School District's case, it was thought that there are a good many children who are afraid to complain under those circumstances.
Okay, it seems that John Binion could very easily and quickly put the prayer issue to rest, partly because he had the Supreme Court backing him up on that. How about the other issue of which John McGean mentioned about the values that the schools promote? Can we get around that? Is it all right to substitute secular values for religious values? Isn't there a danger of secularism becoming a religion and they are becoming sterile as far as value orientations are concerned, except those that are not agreed upon by religion? John?
Well, I did my homework. Fred gave us this list of questions, and I had written to that no.
Could you elaborate?
I'll see if I can remember why I said that. I think that secularism is it should be at the basis of any kind of educational system. I think that
it is not
a religion. Yes, I do. When I interview teachers for positions, I think that it is very important that they understand, although the atmosphere of Judge Memorial High School, which is a high school which is a voluntary private school and built around Catholic values, supportive of Catholic values, if a classroom is to be studying something like Albert Camus, if they're going to be reading The Stranger in an advanced placement English class, I think that there can be some very damaging effects done to that novel, to that particular literary work, if it seems to have to be somehow examined through the context of strictly religious ideals. And so even in a school which is legitimately religious and deliberately religious, we must make an effort to keep the learning process independent of anything which would rigidify it, so that schools can continue to be schools and not propaganda camps, and not camps which are simply indoctrinating its students. I think that that is the danger, as well as the singleness of purpose of public school systems is both its strength and its weakness. And I think that that's an interesting point.
However, Paul Vitz, in article entitled Religion and Traditional Values in Public School Textbooks, points out that there is a danger of overreacting, suggesting that religion indeed has more, for instance, to do with the history and sociology of our nation than any school text now dares to point up. With only the pilgrims mentioned in history and the Amish, which he terms a fringe group, I don't know if they'd like that or not, mentioned contemporarily. And he goes on to say, Americans are as religious today as they have ever been, and perhaps more so. The problem with our textbooks, then, is that they convey a distorted picture of the world, suggesting that religious beliefs and practices are marginal, old-fashioned, and not important for students to know about. I guess in the context of Utah, the enactment of a local elementary school of hand carts is as much excitement and adventure and a joy for children who are not LDS as children who are, and it is good in that sense to raise up the part that religion played in settling Utah, as long as they mention Father Escalante.
You would have no objection to that.
No, we don't have an objection.
No, I think Glenn has raised a real important issue, which is essentially the struggle in any educational setting between two dual purposes. And the one is to recreate our culture. And Will Durant talked about education as the way in which a culture is rediscovered by each new generation. We aren't born with an education or an understanding of our heritage or of the human experience. We learn it through our education. And the desire of parents to have an education system that helps them pass on a culture and a set of values go with that. But the new rhetoric, the catchword attached to the other purpose of education, we talk a lot about teaching critical thinking skills. That's the new thing we use as a purpose of education. Are schools designed to put up a setting, to establish a setting in which those multiple perspectives on religion, understanding what Islam is and why it's been such a force in the history of the world, and knowing what the Feast of Ramadan is, and spending time learning those things, but also confronting the conundrums in human beliefs that those different religious views present, can in fact serve as a medium in which a very important human cognitive skill is learned. You can't teach critical thinking if there's no conflicting value or no conflicting belief or nothing to juxtapose against something else, no logical way to exercise that cognitive skill. And so it is true, in fact, as Glenn pointed out, that you can be that the chilling effect can go both ways. We can both be so frightened to discuss, and I was a history teacher in the high schools, and so I taught a world religions class. But to discuss those religions in a way in which we confront and help young people confront their own critical thinking skills and the belief structures that they hold and that others hold in the world, and find a place for themselves in the world in that way, we can be frightened to do that for fear someone will say we're teaching religion. But the chilling effect can also make us so concerned about religion that we can teach only those values that we know the majority of people aren't going to get on our tails for teaching. And so we can both become totally frightened about talking about an important thing in American life and totally unable to confront those different perspectives that make the world a rich place. So it's not an easy question.
Are you saying, Anne, then, that the Utah schools do not enhance the
critical thinking,
multiple perspectives, and they don't do that partly because of a Mormon influence?
No.
No,
I'm not. What I am arguing is that in Utah, the influence is Mormon. In Tennessee, the influence is fundamentalist Christian. In Massachusetts, in parts of Boston, the influence may be a very conservative form of Catholicism as opposed to a more liberal form of Catholicism.
And all of these
but what we're talking about is the public schools in a cultural environment and the conflicting values of education and culture. William Jennings Bryan argued at the time of the Scopes trials that the people who pay for the schools have a right to determine what is taught in them. That argument has a compelling appeal.
Paying the piper.
At the same time, we have a broader human commitment to what education means and to the conflicting purposes that it sets up in our lives. I say we let the ambiguity rest and deal with it every day, almost revel in it, and never forget to confront it.
Can education in Utah have a greater perspective than that supplied by the local culture? Aren't you setting yourself on a collision course there, if you follow that?
You're saying that we can't raise those multiple perspectives?
No, I think he's saying that because there is one...
There is a perspective.
Yeah, so dominant that, in fact, it's hard to get kids to even see something different. That tension is a big part of our history. Our national motto indicates that. The E Pluribus Unum. We both want to be pluralistic and united at the same time. And it's one of those really lovely paradoxes that, I like your word, revel. We ought to revel in it rather than run away from it. We have to deal with issues of unity as well as issues of pluralism at the same time. Those values, though, that are dominant in this community or in any other community, I don't think are terribly different from community to community, because they are the values that derive from our basic documents. And it's easy to identify which ones they are. Freedom, justice, property, all you have to do is look at the basic documents and you can see them. That doesn't mean that there will not be disagreement, though, but the disagreement, it seems to me, comes not at the level of the value, but at the value judgment level that we make based on our interpretation of that value. I think it's terribly important for us to make the distinction between a value and a value judgment that we make, because at the value judgment level we get deep conflict, and it's manifested in political parties and in all sorts of other things. But at the value level we have commitment, and in fact we have to have. It is impossible for a pluralistic society to even hold together without firm commitment to common values. Those common values are what Gunnar Myrdal said in the American Dilemma, are the glue that hold the society together. And so in this community, or in Boise where I live, or in Massachusetts where I've lived, those values are pretty much the same in any community. And they are the glue, in fact, that make diversity and plurality possible.
Well, why is there a controversy? Why do non-Mormons in Utah schools get upset?
Because we don't all agree with Lamont that there is a difference in values between a Protestant ecumenical Christian child and a LDS child. If there weren't, we'd be going to the same church. I think there is a... When you get into values, there is a given that the values are going to be reflective of the dominant culture and society, no matter what that may be. That's acceptance. But as soon as it becomes a part of the curriculum, I guess arguing sociologically and historically, I think the man who raised up Paul Vitz, who I earlier quoted, was Charles Glenn, who is the director of Equal Educational Opportunity in Massachusetts and also, by his own definition, a fundamentalist Christian. He, in his article in Christian Century, goes on and suggests that the first is to teach students the essential elements of the Christian tradition so that they are familiar with the heart of the Bible. He's suggesting this for public schools, and I've got it underlined because I do not agree. Indeed, several Supreme Court justices have commented that our literature and art presuppose a basic knowledge of the Bible, and therefore teaching it objectively does not violate the separation of church and state. It immediately does in Utah because of the prominence of other books, other religious basic books. And how are you going to bring in the Book of Mormon, the Pearl of Great Price, or Doctrines and Covenants, and deal with that objectively? Well, if you only use the Bible...
Interpret the Bible.
I think the greatest common value, one of the greatest common values that is the glue for our country, is that religion and religious values are not among those common values. I think that is at the very heart of the American system, and I do feel that it is also the center of controversy here, that as soon as those common values become religious values, then there is conflict when someone else does not accept.
And those common values are civic values, they are secular values, they are humanistic values, and I've tried now for several years to figure out how to describe myself as a secular humanist without tarring myself. But I clearly
am. And still
am.
Be a Mormon.
And still be a Mormon, and still be on the High Council. it's difficult, but I am a secular humanist. My basic values are those fairly old Enlightenment secular values. Those are the values that fired our energized our founders. They're the values that the Supreme Court has spent now two centuries trying to figure out what they mean. They're the values that we discuss. The undergird the issues that are political issues, and so rather than make religious values the core of the curriculum, I would want to make those secular or civic values the core of the curriculum, because in fact public school, in my view, has only one legitimate purpose, and that's a civic purpose. There's no other good reason to tax people to support public schools, because private schools can teach reading and writing and arithmetic. Homeschools can do it. The primary purpose, the historic purpose of public education, common school education in America, has been to instill the dominant civic values. Now, I have a problem immediately with instill, because I also am quite easily offended if it seems to me that we're indoctrinating. So it seems to me that a primary purpose is, as Ann said, that for school is to get kids to think critically. But critical thinking and commitment are not necessarily antagonistic. They are not necessarily opposites. And to invite kids to critically examine values is not to at the same time tell them that they cannot have some beliefs or have some commitments. It seems to me that we're always in a cycle of examining our commitments and making recommitments and commitments to values that are altered because of this critical thinking process that we go through.
Is it okay then for a public school to raise the issue of the evolution, for example? There's the creationist approach and there's the scientific approach. Should the public school, you're saying that the public school, most of you have said this, the public school's main purpose is the promotion of critical thinking in students. Should public school teachers have as their major role challenging student beliefs about how the world was created?
I don't think that prelude to that question fits your question.
Take my question then.
All right. There is a difference between, for instance, in a world history class, studying the Gilgamesh epic and the flood stories that have existed in multiple civilizations across time, and including in that discussion the flood story in the Bible as one of them, and finding that common thread in world mythology and world religious stories, and telling a child that they haven't the right to believe in that story. And what you've, I think, put your finger on is that delicate individual human balance that goes right into the individual classroom. We can have in Provo school districts a policy against prayer, or be devoid of that policy in Alpine school district, or not even have to have one in one of the metropolitan Salt Lake districts because no one would thought to have a prayer. But at the same time, the way an individual teacher, the way a faculty in a school shows respect for one another's beliefs, shows a commitment to a broad liberal education in the finest tradition, and then nurtures an environment where all of those ideas can be discussed and held up for examination without the atmosphere of ridicule, is the fundamental issue in education, and one that will be rooted in whether we care if we respect the values of other people. I think one of the issues that Glenn has raised is that very fundamental personal question. Does the teacher in that classroom respect and care whether a child in that classroom feels that their beliefs have been held up to ridicule? And can we set up our educational curriculum and instruction and pedagogy in ways in which multiple ideas are discussed and no one's ideas are ridiculed? Now, the evolution question, I think, is one which raises what is theology, what is science, and the American Association for the Advancement of Science, among others, including a large core of recent Nobel Prize laureates, have argued that the debate is in the wrong arena. This isn't science, this is religion. And if you are to teach a creation story, then teach it in a setting in which multiple creation stories are taught. If we're going to teach biology, then evolution as a theory of the origins of the earth goes in that arena. Not that creationism or creation stories mustn't be confronted in world religion classes, but that evolution is a science curriculum subject. And that debate is going to keep going too, because we will argue about whether it's science or religion. I think that individual sensitivity is the main issue.
There's even a debate within the debate, I suppose. That one, a young person who went through my confirmation class, at least, could listen to the theory of evolution and find it not at all contradictory to our belief in creationism or the creation story, because we don't believe in creationism as a religious community in the United Church of Christ. But some small groupings within our tradition do. But essentially, you know, you can't just set theology aside. Our children would not be disturbed at all by the theory of evolution, simply because their belief in the creation story doesn't conflict with that at all. And I think that's the right conclusion.
Well, and I think that's why the scientists argue that creation science, as it's currently promoted, is a sectarian issue.
Yeah, that's right.
Anne is talking about something that makes great sense to me. I do agree that the science departments are the place for the study of Darwin, and that the study of creationism has its place elsewhere. But in a community where 94% of its population is a single faith, and if within that community the theories of Darwin and evolution are not being taught right now, are being avoided in the biology department and elsewhere, then we have a more practical responsibility to try to do something about that. And I think that gets at the whole basis of, again, education being a drawing out, and in order to draw out instead of simply to indoctrinate, you have to be prepared to present these other kinds of ideas to them. So from a practical point of view, I think that it would be a real nice thing if we could get these schools to, they have a high responsibility, it seems to me, in some of our school districts, which have 95% of its students are LDS, to continually be finding things which are countercultural, with which to teach the students, to kind of prepare them for a life of open-mindedness and tolerance. And I think that should be a responsibility of LDS officials and stakes and wards to make certain that their schools are providing their students with that kind of, because I do think that there is a good deal of power in that avenue.
John, do you say you know a high school in Utah where evolution isn't taught in biology, and it's because of the Mormon influence?
I don't have, as I said, Lamond, over our English muffins this morning, I really don't have, I know of stories that is the case, but I cannot provide you with specific instances. I'm really sorry that I don't have that right now, but I have been told that many of the schools in Utah County, specifically in the Alpine School District, do not offer a unit on evolution in their biology courses.
Well, this has been enlightening for me then, because it has been, things have changed maybe since I taught in Utah, or maybe I taught in a school unlike what you're describing. I find that incredible that there would be a community in Utah where evolution is an issue such that it wouldn't be taught in a school. I don't find it incredible that there are other issues that would be so volatile that wouldn't be touched on in school, but evolution is one that I find incredible, because I thought we put that one to rest a long time ago.
You haven't lived in Utah, have you?
In an interview with the science supervisor of Granite District some years ago, who has taught science for multiple decades in Utah, he informed me that the chilling effect has made science instruction in Utah less professional than it was 20 years ago or 30 years ago. And that, in fact, even 50 or 60 years ago, Lynn Binion's dad came out strongly in the support of the instruction of evolution in the Utah schools. And we may, in fact, have more conservative pressures against that now than we ever have in Utah. And there are many Mormon theologians who have written against that biological theory, and there are people who agree with them. And that
the audience participate here. Ray, did you have a question you wanted to ask? A short comment and question.
Well, we collected our data. We did the Roe Keats thing.
His name is Ray.
There is a CARA organization, I think it's the Catholic Apostolate for Research in Science and Religion. And I replicated part of their study in Utah and showed insignificant differences between Mormons and non-Mormons on basic manual areas. I taught in Westminster for 10 years, left public school to go there. And Westminster is a place where a significant number of people send their kids so they don't have to go to the Mormon-dominated University of Utah. I find in lecture method, I have to change my lecture method because I think the thing that you're most concerned about is not the value issue, but the references to the church. And I have to find in my lecture method that I could not use analogy. That the well hungry home teachers can't hand. Those are the sorts of things that you have to be careful about.
For good reason. But
in the question of values, and as a religious leader myself, there are certain values of society that are affirmed in the traditional Mormon context that as a religious leader, I would like to disaffirm among my confirmants. So I'm saying I agree with you in pretty much, except that when you get into the question of values, there's the gray area because there are a lot of values that clear across this country hold sway right now that in our particular religious tradition are wrong, but in another one's religious tradition may be right.
I'd also like to raise the issue that middle-class white is a more dominant social pressure in Utah and in the schools than
Mormon.
That our kids do better on their SAT tests because kids whose parents went to school do better on their SAT tests, and that this culture promotes those. That this social class homogeneity of Utah is the more dominant force in the quality of our public schools than our Mormon traditional values about education.
In other words, we're the epitome of the middle class.
We're middle class, and that we impose those values as well.
I'm really interested in this value, but I think we have to define that values gets to be a dirty word. And I taught an interesting school. I just quit last year, 3 years before I retired, because I want to address this to the public. And I taught in a school that was hand-picked, the students in an inner-city school. We had 7 different languages, the Bold people, the Spanish people. We had every color, creed, and kind teacher. And we did a 3-year study on philosophy of what we would do with these children. The children were from lower economic classes, and I think that sometimes we hit at gnats and we swallow a camel because these kids needed values. I'm talking about human, universal values. Mm-hmm. Now, I found, and interestingly, no one had touched that, a set of books put out by Arista Company years ago during the civil rights movement. And we did a great deal in that school on brotherhood, tolerance. That's what we found we had to do. But we had to start out on something very basic with those children. We had immigrant children from Mexico and things. And we had to start out on patriotism. We had to pledge the flag every morning and start out with maybe God Bless America, because those kids had no rootings. They had no moorings. And I think sometimes, I don't know if you've been in the public schools, I'm talking about the roots down on the elementary level. I think when you've been shot, a hangnail doesn't really count very much. And that is the thing that we're facing right now. And another thing, I think, when we've got 1 out of 5 children that can't read, and I had all the children that couldn't read, and I thought, I cannot sit and drill and drill the phonics, because the purpose of my teaching is to teach children to read. So I finally discovered an easy way to teach them to read, to get them to good literature. When you're talking about critiquing, getting children to do critical thinking, hey, listen, if we need to get them to sit down and listen to us, our classes were overcrowded, and I mean about 60% of our time is spent in discipline. Now, what I'm saying about public schools, I think we ought to talk about, can we save the public school system, because it is in deep trouble right now in every way. And I think it's going to take all of us together, regardless of color, creed, or crime. Now, I happen to be a Mormon, and I was sitting with a Buddhist and a
Baptist and a Protestant and a Catholic and everything else. And after I taught with them for 10 years, I'll tell you how much influence I've had. As long as somebody asked me, said, "Are you a Christian?" I thought, "You're a Mormon, but do you believe in Christ?" I can believe these were my friends that at D school in Ogden.
In Ogden.
I have a teacher here from the college that would have passed us on these things.
Well, we're getting off from values, but even
values. We have to teach values.
You mentioned something very interesting in values, that you taught patriotism. Now, my values tell me that what my children are indoctrinated in many of the schools in Utah has left the pale of patriotism and crossed into nationalism. And there's a fine difference there too. So we don't endorse nationalism. Well, I'm just raising the point that when you're dealing with values, you're in gray areas. Yes, sir.
What are these secular and civic values that, maybe my question is directed more to Mr. Lyons, that seem to be the glue that hold the public school system together in the absence of the religious values you talked about?
Well, I think the dominant humanistic value is the commitment to the dignity and worth of individuals. That's the root value. Others, I suggest you go to the to our basic documents, and just happen to have
the Constitution.
Well, don't have the Constitution, but Freeman Butts, in his wonderful book a few years ago, Revival of Civic Learning, in it published what he made apologies to Aristotle and to Moses, because he said he's got a decalogue of these civic values, and this is what they are: justice, equality, authority, participation, personal obligation for the public good. And by the way, those he puts under the column of the unum, a part of our motto, and then under the pluribus part of our motto, freedom, diversity, privacy, due process, and international human rights. Now, all of those, he says, also have corrupted forms. And the corrupted forms might be those that are taught in the Mormon public schools. I don't know. They become corrupted when we get at the value judgment level.
The Mormons wouldn't see them as corrupted. They would see them as authentic and pure.
No, what I mean by that is that we may have, for example, a commitment to the value of authority, and that's one that I think Mormons can easily identify with. A corrupted form of authority, of the value of authority, is authoritarianism. And none of us want to try to instill an unthinking commitment to authority or obedience. I don't think we do. Nonetheless, if we don't have a healthy respect for authority, then a democratic system cannot work. Those, to me, are secular values. They're humanistic values that have little or nothing to do with religion. I don't think they're rooted in religion. It just so happens that they are very compatible with the Mormon religion or Protestant religions or Catholic religion or Jewish religion and many of the Eastern religions. But the individual value judgments we make based on those, we may find terrible disagreement in this group, and that's manifest in all sorts of ways. I'm not the least bit interested in trying to instill or inculcate specific value judgments. But I'm terribly interested in getting a thorough examination of and a recommitment to and a redefinition to those basic values. Now, I want to read just one tiny little excerpt from John Gardner when he's, oops, where is it? Here it is. In his book several years ago, Self-Renewal, he said, "Instead of giving young people the impression that it is their task to stand a dreary watch over the ancient values, we should be telling them the grim but bracing truth that it is their task to recreate those values continuously in their own behavior. Facing the dilemmas and catastrophes of their own time, we should be telling them that each generation refights the critical battles and either brings new vitality to those values or ideals or allows them to decay. And so, again, I don't think that commitment and rationality are, they are in tension, but they are not contradictory.
I would like to add, I don't think that any of us believe that the public schools should take on as a goal the annihilation of the culture that created them. And that's why I think some of this, some of the questions that we pose today really are conundrums, and they will remain ambiguous and there unsolved. Because I know that when I send my seven-year-old daughter to second grade next week, week after next, that I don't expect her to come marching home a good little Nazi. That's not what I expect from the schools. So I truly don't think that we want to commit cultural suicide in Utah through the public schools. I think what we all, however, have to be aware of is the difference between the analogy, as Ray pointed out, that people have come together in a setting, the kinds of analogies that we use where we talk about your home teachers or your bishop or your ward, where we use a certain kind of prayer, when we use catchwords that belong really to one very small group, and confronting those conflicts that will rise for all children in their lives. So we take care with our rhetoric. We don't talk about mutual during social studies class. We don't use the ward teachers or your primary teacher or what your bishop said, or we don't send home surveys to kids who ask them what ward they live in. And we don't do those things because we care about and love the people we live with who aren't Mormons. But we also continue to face these hard questions about what our core values are in the culture that we share. And I don't know that, given the way American culture is becoming more and more pluralized, that common list is always going to be not up for grabs.
I've got to agree that we shouldn't damage those cultures that started public education in Utah, because Fred Buchanan tells me it was the Presbyterians and the Congregationalists.
That's right.
No, and I would really agree with everything said in that, except instead of don't, we should say shouldn't. Because in Utah Valley, we sure insensitively do have that kind of religious jargon in our everyday patterns. You've got to separate some things that the school district can do and the school district can't do. And I'm afraid that's something that the minority people contend with, will occasionally object to, will continue to raise up and have every right to raise up and have every right to have corrected, but I'm pessimistic as to whether it ever will be.
The sister in the pink thing. No, the lady in the pink.
I wanted to ask,
Ray,
you mentioned non-LDS unfair judgments on LDS majorities. For instance, Cancer Society cannot launch a non-smoking campaign in Utah because it will be seen as a religious issue, where they've launched many non-smoking campaigns in other states. And I was impressed that Judge High School sent out with their parent-teacher organization, who would be signed something that would say we would not serve alcohol in our home as party in party setting for minors that were going to the high school, whereas East High School could never do that because that would be construed as as religious Mormon influence because Mormons don't believe in alcohol. And I'd like to ask the non-LDS people, is there a way in which these kinds of values, which seem to me as common values, at least in regards to our education and our children, that can be taken out of the Mormon, non-Mormon context?
John, would you like to comment that name then?
Well, I do agree that we're speaking, you know, we're picking on our best example when we discuss Utah County and places like the Alpine School District specifically, where there is that immense homogeneity. When you, my wife went to East High School, and I received quite a stern admonition this morning to mention that that she felt very much, and she was Presbyterian, very much a part of that school, and she felt very little LDS influence. I have, just in my own professional interaction with the public school system, encountered a good number of prayers at teacher meetings and things like this, which are confuse me anyway, why a public school would begin any teacher meeting with any kind of prayer. If I had been asked to begin a prayer, I would not start the sign of the cross and pray there, because I feel that would be equally inappropriate. I think that there has been some growth in the city schools where seminary is no longer listed as one of the courses on the report cards which are sent out, and that used to happen, I know, when I was going to high school in the Valley. I do believe that if you look at a school which is closer to the University of Utah, the pocket of a school like East High School is very much more removed from the effects of LDS culture than a school which might be out in another area in Salt Lake Valley, like Brighton High School, for instance, where there would be more of that. And that's my gut feeling, as well as in part some experience that I've had.
Glenn?
I think that the very nature of the topic can paint a rather unfair picture if everything was to be, you know, a broad sweep. I'm amazed at how my fellow panelists were amazed at breakfast this morning as I recited some things we just take for granted down in Utah Valley. So it is different.
Mm-hmm.
It is different.
Can you give us some examples?
No. That would be unfair, and I'm a very fair person. Mm-hmm. First of all, the American Cancer Society, which I was a board member for several months in Utah Valley, conducts a vigorous anti-smoking campaign with no such concern. Secondly, minorities have a right to be unfair, and they have to be to keep the majority off balance. In Chicago, it's called doing their black thing, and it's keeping you on your heels, so you're watching where the next swipe is going to come from. We have a very, very difficult task because the situations are isolated. In one item newspaper here, I remarked that the situations are isolated, but when it happens to one child, it happens to one child too many. So we'll keep pushing. And at times it won't be fair, and we will be wrong. Not me. I'm always fair. I'm never wrong.
It seems that it's not a peculiarly, it's peculiarly Mormon in that Utah has a high percentage of Mormons, but it seems to me that the similar problems could probably be identified in the South and in other areas. Would you agree that it's not a
no,
that it's a human problem?
No, I think Utah is very
unique,
very peculiar. Right. I don't think you can find common problems in the rest of the nation.
Mr. Luke?
I'd like to add to the Reverend Halby's arsenal the story.
Makes me sound very warlike there.
The late BYU president, Ernest Wilkinson, gave a prayer to the BYU team preceding a football game, in which he prayed that the quarterback would be blessed with dexterous hands so he wouldn't fumble the ball.
Did he?
No. If Wilkinson were the president, that must not have come true. They didn't win any football games then. So.
Brigham Young University is a private school, and I am not going to, you know, to begin to say that I don't believe in the efficacy of prayer in a religious school. I think that's an entirely different issue. What I object to is when Coach Bojack from Jordan High School does the very same thing, and then I see we have trouble, because I am a pulling guard and I'm a Buddhist, and I object to that because I suddenly feel very alienated from something which is called a team. And I think that that sort of metaphor can be extended, of course, into the classroom. And what I am suggesting, we all know that the Mormon beliefs, that the Mormon influence is keenly felt in all of our public schools. We all know that's true. And I think that what you have to do, not me, what you have to do is everything you can possibly do to keep that out of the schools, and to work as much as possible to bring new ideas into the classroom, to have people deal with. I think you build values not through indoctrination, but through confrontation with opposites. I think that's John Milton and Arya Pergetic had insisted that, you know, as soon as we begin to burn books, we lose value structures. A student does not have a value system if it has not been tested. It is simply not a value system at all.
Do you see it, the role of the school is to test those value systems?
Yes.
I do. In fact, a lot of what I've said...
Isn't that where the issue becomes joined? Because many parents, Mormon parents and others, would resent that as a function of the school. You have no right to test the values that I transmit to my children.
Well,
my children.
Let me address that from a very practical sense that has been raised. John brought it up, that BYU is a private school. And that is part of the privatization of the public school system in Utah. And I'm going to refer to Dawn Tracy's article, an interview with Professor Garfield, Rulon Garfield from BYU, 4 years ago in 1982. And that was as a result of a series she did on school policies of the three school districts in Utah County. And in that, the school officials said they don't have to advertise for public school teachers because they have enough school teachers supplied to them without such advertising. And to update that a bit, in preparation for this panel, I called the four school districts in our valley, three being in our county. And 80% Alpine School District placement person said among new hires, 80% were from BYU, 94% were from BYU, Utah State, University of Utah, Weber State, and only 6% from out of state because they were not advertised, apparently.
What was the percentage for the University of Utah?
You know, if 80% from BYU, you didn't get much. Nebo School District, Joyce Thomas told me, and here I got it broken down, Fred, you come out very poorly. BYU, 75%. This is total faculty. Utah State, 10%. Southern Utah State University, 5%. University of Utah, 3%. You beat Weber. They only had 1%. 6%, again, from out of state. Provo School District, same, 75% from BYU, 20% Utah State University, and 5% out of state. Nephi School District, on two phone calls and one letter, refused to respond. Now, I suppose the Lawrence School System may draw heavily from the University of Kansas in Lawrence, Kansas. But I think the fact and the point that John made about BYU being a private school and a solidly religiously based school does address some of the problems and the question about whether Utah public schools can be, in that sense, public. And I don't think there's any, you know, legal recourse, except I believe until they do advertise, until they do go through school journals and get a lot of ski bums in here from New Jersey and Pennsylvania as school teachers, capitalize on the ideal features of Utah and attract more student teachers from out of state by advertising, you will always have these dominant values carried out by this unusual percentage supplied by a private religious school.
Would administration be the same percentages? Would you see that?
Yes. In administration, we place a large percentage of our students outside the state. And it depends on the districts. There are districts with reputations for hiring only BYU administratively to only. Well, now I'm gonna fudge on that. There are districts with reputations. It's wonderful. There are rumors all over for pressuring those interested in administration in their districts into attending the BYU for a variety of reasons. And there are lots of apocryphal stories around, one of which I'd be happy to share because it happened to me. But it's not apocryphal. Well, why would you want to go to this university when you can go to this one? And all of us went to this one, and that'll make us all one for all and all for one. But there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that the BYU has a very large College of Education, that they have chosen to invest large resources in teacher training, and in fact are one of the largest teacher training universities in the nation, not just in the state, and have chosen to value education and to put money into that college, and consequently they turn out large number of teachers. The problem that Glenn points out is a real subtle one, and that's that, as we know in management, we tend to hire people who are like us. We do lots of studies about leadership qualities and grade point averages and what helps people be successful, but we find in the long run what we do is hire people who are most like us, whom we feel comfortable with. And so it's a self-perpetuating problem that unless people raise the question, why did you hire this person? No one will ask that question. And so just talking about it will help. But I don't know that we can blame the Y for training lots of teachers. That's one of the missions they've taken on.
I think it's important, too, that Rulon Garfield, who is a professor, in 82 was, agrees with you completely. He said it's cloning, and that was the headline given to it.
So what we are asking then is, should we ask the College of Education at Brigham Young to talk about cultural pluralism and the role of the teacher in addressing it, rather than wondering why Brigham Young chooses to educate so many teachers?
We just abolished the cultural foundations department. So
I wouldn't ask BYU a thing. I would ask the public school districts to start advertising their openings.
Well, I think I would ask of some things of BYU, and I have no idea whether they're doing them or not, so I'm now not indicting. I'm only saying that, in fact, if they are not getting prospective teachers to see education both as a conserving activity, as we've talked about a great deal, and much of what I've said has had that conserving aspect to it, but also see it as a subverting or changing activity, then I think their teacher preparation program is inadequate. Any good teacher education program ought to, in fact, have put value on cultural pluralism. It ought to put value on the conserving nature of education. It ought to put value on the subverting or changing nature of education. If I find a group of undergraduate or graduate students who seem to be too heavily into the conserving aspects, then I purposely try to subvert them. I tell them that teaching is a subversive activity, and go through activities to get them to challenge their beliefs so that they might also have then a broader view.
I wonder if that's really genuinely possible among Mormons. I can remember as a graduate student at the University of Utah having a graduate seminar on the Reformation. And the students in the class, the professor, Emil Lucky, had a dickens of a time just getting the Mormons in the class to say there's a possibility that their value system is not the only one. I mean, they couldn't get to base one.
Well, it is possible, because To the extent it's happened to me, it's possible.
And you're still a high councilman.
Well, in fact, it happened to me at BYU.
Yeah.
A history professor that was the one that subverted my value system, and I'm grateful.
What's his name?
Well, he's not there anymore because, and in fact, he was trouble.
Well,
but nonetheless, I'm saying it can happen and it does happen.
I need to jump in as well and argue for there are many arenas in which different socialization processes create people's values. One of the things we do at universities is socialize professors to value certain things. If you're at a major at a university that wants to be a major research university, you're trained and socialized to value research and to put energy and time into it. And we move professors around the country and we talk about inbreeding and we worry about it because we want professors to be socialized in a certain way. We do the same thing with education and educational administrators. There are socialization processes that we go through that in many ways set us up in a given arena to behave differently than we personally would behave when we were making a personal choice. When Scalia was going through his confirmation hearings for the Supreme Court, he argued that he was capable of judging legal issues placed before him on the basis of the legal questions, regardless of his personal value structure. And I can testify personally that Utah County school districts are, some of them, going out of their way to hunt down some different kinds of people. I was a PhD at the University of Utah, 35 years old with four daughters, when John Bennion recruited me to the principalship at Fair Junior High, right on Center Street in Provo. And there were a lot of sighs and gasps and worries, not just from the people in Utah County, but from the people at the U of U who said, how can you function there?
And what if you were Jewish?
That's one of the things the other people said. Is that everybody knew I was Mormon. But I don't know if... I think you're right, John, but little signs of progress need to be rewarded, and then we need to push ourselves farther to go and recruit some of our students who are Jewish and some of our students who are Catholic into those same settings, socialized in education, in schools, to value those things that we value, and learning to behave in ways that professionally match a variety of people's needs in the education system. So let's praise our small signs of progress and push for more. I had a thoroughly pleasing experience as an administrator in the Provo School District. But those questions that we have raised today were continually raised in that setting in which I worked.
I think that the sensitivity to young people is very important. There was a newspaper letter to the editor by Tim Boyd, aged 11, appeared in the Salt Lake Tribune just a few months ago. It's quite an experience living in Utah and being non-Mormon. It's very tough to feel like you fit in at school because all the kids know each other from their wards and aren't friendly with non-Mormons. In my neighborhood, it's the same way. I don't have any friends because I don't go to their church, so I'm considered an outsider. I once tried to join the Cub Scouts, but it seemed that every time there was an activity, I never heard about it because it was announced in church. So I dropped. Hopefully, when I get to junior high, I'll make more friends because there will be more kids. There'll be a bigger school, and it won't seem so lonely.
You know, one of the most pernicious kind of things in that regard is that even in the church, when we talk about being friendly to the other kids in school, it is not out of that basic human value that we're talking about that would motivate it. Too often, I'm afraid that it's out of that's the way you do your missionary work, is to be friendly with non-Mormons in your school. I just think we have to work at building that deep commitment to that basic core value of the dignity and worth of the individual, no matter what.
As a personal anecdote from my own experience, growing up as a Mormon in the west of Scotland, the only Mormon boy in the whole county of Ayr, which was about 1.5 million people, I remember in the second or third grade, we were having Bible stories. Now, this is public school, and we were having Bible stories, and the Bible story was on Joseph and his coat of many colors.
And I remember right in the middle of the story, I put out my hand. I can still see myself doing it because I felt so proud of it. I said, "Please, miss," I says, "I know Joseph's second name." And she said, "What was it?" And I said, "Smith." And then about 6 years later, and I kept quiet, the response was, "You're confused." About 6 years later, I was sitting in a geography class, and the geography teacher was doing American geography, and he pointed out Utah, and I got very excited because I knew something about Utah, and he said, "What's this place?" And I said, "That's Utah." And he said, "Yes, that's where the Mormons live. They're not very nice people." So that was the end of my confrontation with the system there. But because children are very vulnerable to those kind of comments. Well, I think what Anne is saying is that there's a need to raise the level of awareness among teachers and administrators that we're not all the same, and that even Mormons are not all the same, and that there's more diversity among the Mormons than sometimes we pretend.
Anne raised up a question that William Jennings Bryan claimed, that the majority in a culture has that inherent right to shape public education and cultural influences. And that was one of our guideline questions that Fred posed for the panel in preparation for this day. And it may be unfair, but I'm just going to tell you how emotionally I respond to that. That's somewhat like asking Cottonwood Canyon if it has a right to have an avalanche or a rock slide. It's pretty unavoidable. And I don't think that's the school system's fault. And that is what we, as a minority people, accept. And as I say, there will always be those correcting dialogues. I hope there always will be. That's what I believe is the real love that we have for Utah, to always engage in those dialogues when there are excesses. And I would simply remark that one of my confirmands, I asked her again in preparation for this panel, and all her remarks were positive. But she finally came, and I may have quoted her already, she finally came to the point of saying, "But if you let someone know you're not Mormon, you lose a friend." And she was a very quiet girl, and a very quiet tear just fell right down her cheek. And I think that kind of sensitivity has got to always be called for. And I might say, too, as far as the others are concerned, and a question Fred posed, how will increased heterogeneity of Utah's population affect the issue of Mormon influence? Right now, the economy in Utah Valley is down. It's flat. Flatter than a pancake. In fact, a little depressed. The first one's leaving. I don't think any ward in Provo can show you an exodus of people leaving the town and leaving the state than our small little church and almost every Protestant church in the valley can show you. The ones who are not, Utah is different, and Utah is looked at skeptically by outsiders before they come in. Only when we come in do we love it as much as we do, and I love it. But when the economics are bad, then some of the adverse situations which they otherwise would tolerate grow intolerable, and they do leave.
Reducing the pluralism.
Heterogeneity, right. Yeah.
There was a couple of you had questions. The gentleman next to John Bennion there, you had a question, and then this gentleman over here. We have about five minutes.
Decided to repent, but address the question, how public are you? Find what public means. Does that mean does it mean the American public? Does it mean that it's representative of the public in our party? Are you addressing a different question? Maybe it's how pluralistic are and how responsive are Utah schools to the specific groups that are within it?
That's really what we've been addressing, right? Question? Yes, Lynn?
Fred, bring this very stimulating and well-prepared panel back next year to such a seminar with a different title. I misconstrued my anticipated theme here. I think the real question, we get a much larger audience, the degree of Mormon influence in the public schools of Utah, something of that kind, as a changed title, would be more appealing to a larger audience.
Yeah.
Because
my subtitle was, Are Utah Schools a Private School System? But they didn't put that on the title. Question there.
I was going to say that it seems to me that the thrust of much of what the panel has said is that we need more tolerance in our schools. We need more equality of treatment. But I wonder if we can't ask more of our educational system than that. Isn't it true that the kind of friction and stress and tension and academic excitation that is the essence of true education is very lacking here and very impossible in this monolithic society? If I could make one more comment about that. Last night in the plenary session, we saw three or four professional academicians, and it seemed very clear that there was no tamper of stress or no controversy with them because they had only one point of view. And I wonder if we see that kind of problem with professional academicians, if we're ever going to resolve it on a lower level.
The panel, Anne, would you like to?
I wasn't at the session, so I don't know what.
But I
see what you mean. If we all agree, if we're all so much alike that we all agree, how can we set up creative tension? Is that the sense that you're asking?
I can remember Waldemar Beery saying 20 years ago
is the freedom
of this local culture that. He used the Jewish society as an example and said that the great excitation that existed there, which almost burst society asunder, led to great academic achievement. He used it as an example.
Yeah, I would agree.
We never hope for anything like that in our own society.
Well, I think that as long as our society values obedience as one of the highest and to authority as one of our highest values, that we'll have a great deal of difficulty with that. I've often heard several of my LDS friends praise Catholic society exactly the same tensions between the different orders, the Jesuits, the Dominicans, and the Franciscans. And in some ways, the conflict those orders had with one another has been a wellspring of vitality.
Next year, I might find a document going back to 1840, in which Brigham Young expounds a progressive philosophy of education. I'll find that for next year.
Thank you very much.
The letter.